We continue the shiurim Gemara. We were discussing about the laws of marriage, the fact that a man cannot marry a woman against her will, though it is a fact that he may divorce her against her will, and that was true until the time of Rabbeinu Gershom, who made a chidim against that, against the person doing so, only for certain people. Today, of course, it's prevalent throughout the world. But in the laws of marriage, a man cannot marry a woman against her will. That's one thing. And secondly, he cannot marry her for nothing. You cannot get a woman to be your wife without paying for it. You have to be mekadesh, a woman, with something of value. The words under the chuppah are, Hareyat mekudeshet li, you are hereby mekudeshet to me, betrothed to me, be tabat zu, or be kaspa hadin, either with a ring of value or with money, anything that has monetary value. He cannot be mekadesha without anything of monetary value. It must be so. He cannot just say, you are mekadesha to me, period. She's not mekadesha unless he does something, gives her something of value. So the Yemeda says, we can show a case where a man not only be mekadesh a woman without giving her a ring, without giving her money, without giving her value, she can still become a kudeshet to him. He gave her nothing. Not only that, but she even gave him. That's very strange, because it's the man is mekadesh the woman, not the other way around. And yet it's possible that the man is mekadesh the woman while she gives him something. How can that be so? We said the absolute rule is that he cannot be mekadesh her with nothing. He must give her something of value. The Yemeda answers there's a thing called Tovat Hana'ah. Tovat Hana'ah means that she gains, there's a possibility of her gaining, though she receives nothing and though she gives. For example, let's say there's a man of very high standing. He's a very big Talmid Chacham, or he's a very high official in the government. Let's say he's the king, the prince. Now, a person would like to get close to the prince. A person would feel that his greatest thrill would be if he could offer the prince a gift, and the prince would accept this gift. That's the greatest thrill to him. A person would give a lot of money for that thrill, that pleasure. But here's a case where this prince wants to be kadesh, a woman, and she says, I hereby give you a gift. She gives him money, or something of value, and he says to her, with the hana'ah, the pleasure you have of my accepting this gift, you are mikudesha to me. He goes, that is an item of value. So this is a unique possibility where it's possible that a man should take rather than give, and with this taking, she is receiving something enough of value where she becomes mikudesha to him. Now, we come back to the case we're speaking about where a father, the law of a father is to provide for his son. He has certain obligations. We know that the son or the child is obligated to respect the parent and to serve a parent, to honor a parent in every manner possible. That's the rules that a son has, son or a daughter has to a father, to a parent. What are the rules and obligations and responsibilities of a father to a son? Yemeda says that the first responsibility is the father must provide the brit milah for the son. In fact, the mitzvah is that the father should be the mohel himself. In most cases, the great rabbis especially learned how to be a mohel just for the sake of being mohel their own sons, nothing else. So that's how important that is, that they learn it for that specific reason. And if a person cannot find himself adaptable for being a mohel, then he does hire a mohel, but he makes the mohel his shaliach, his messenger, and shlucho shel adam kemoto, the messenger of the person is the same as that person, the sender himself. So it's as though the father himself performed this brit milah. That's the first duty that a father has to a son. If he is a firstborn son, the second duty is that he must make a pidyon haben exactly on the right date. He must make it on the right date, on the right date, the eighth day, the pidyon haben after 30 days. And then following that, his next rule is to teach his son Torah. Teach him himself, if he's not capable, to hire a tutor, a rabbi, to teach him, or to send him to a yeshiva. Beyond that, there's also a law that he must teach his son a trade, because if he does not teach his son a trade, later on in life, a son who might find himself destitute, no means of a livelihood, might turn to thievery. And this would be partially the parent's fault, the father's fault. He did not provide him with a means of earning a livelihood. So this is one of the obligations of a father to a son. Further, too, there's a law that it's the father's duty to marry off his son. Once he has his son married off, then he is free. But he must see to it, seek the right mate for the son, to help select. Though the din is that the son is not required to take the one that the father selects. Even, the Shulchan Aruch says that even if the father commands the son to take a certain girl for a wife, the son is not required to obey the father on this point. He is free to select the one of his own choice, and it is not breaking the law of Kibud Av if he does not listen to the father in this case. Last item the father is required to teach his son is to learn how to swim. Teach him how to swim, because this is a very vital item. It might come in handy just once in this boy's lifetime, but that once could mean his life. So that this, too, is one of the requirements, the Gemara says, the obligations of a father to see that his son learns how to swim. Now, on the other hand, women have a different set of mitzvot. The mother is not required to perform these laws for a child. These are rules only for a father. Except, of course, the teaching the child Torah. This, too, is the duty of the mother to see that the child learns. Take the child, bring the child to yeshiva, see that the child studies. This is the part where the mother takes a hand in. Pasuk says, Kor tomar lebet Yaakov v'taged levnei Yisrael. Teach the Bet Yaakov, the Gemara says, Elohe Nashim, the women, and v'taged levnei Yisrael, not that you should teach the children, the sons, but v'taged, she, Lashon Estad, she should teach this, transmit this to Bnei Yisrael, the children. Now, as far as the mitzvot that a woman herself has to perform, the Gemara says she's very different than a man, because a man has to perform, is required to fulfill all the 613 mitzvot of the Torah. In the Torah, we have Tariag mitzvot, 613 mitzvot, that are divided into two parts. One is called mitzvot aseh, a positive mitzvot, one is mitzvot lot aseh, negative. There are 248 ramach mitzvot aseh, 248 positive mitzvot action that correspond to the organs of the body. A person has 248 organs, and this means every one of his organs is supposed to work, utilized for the sake of the performance of these mitzvot. There are shin samach hei, 365 lot aseh, negative mitzvot. These correspond to the 365 arteries that a person has that carry the blood. Negative means he's supposed to control himself, control his desires, and not to break these laws passively. This means that in case he is brought to a heat, to a passion, the blood turns warm, too hot, with a desire to perform a sin, he has 365 negative mitzvot corresponding to these 365 arteries, meaning he must control the heat, the blood, and not to break these laws. Now, women have a different set of rules. The 365 negative mitzvot, like do not steal, do not eat tarif, and so on, every one of these 365 women must perform. They're required to perform every one of them except three. Only three out of those 365 women are exempt from. Those three are, first, Bal Takif, then Bal Tashchit. That means they're not required to avoid cutting off the peyot. They're allowed to shave off the pair of the sideburns, the hair, and they're allowed to shave if they have hair at place of the beard, whereas a man is forbidden to use a razor, a woman is permitted to use a razor there. Third one is balta tameh, which means that if she is a daughter of a kohen, if she's a kohenet, she does not have the rules of kihuna, where a kohen cannot go to a funeral, cannot go to a cemetery, cannot become tameh near a dead body. A woman is exempt from that law if she's a kohenet. Aside from that, she's required to obey every one of the other 362 remaining negative mitzvot. Of the mitzvot aseh, the positive mitzvot, there they are divided into two parts. One is called zman gerameh, which means mitzvot that are dictated by time, governed by time, as, for example, the mitzvah of tefillin. Tefillin is worn only by day, only during the weekdays, not on Shabbat or holidays. These mitzvot that are governed by time, women are exempt from. So therefore, women do not have to put on tefillin. Tzitzit, too, is only by day and not at night. There is a time limit for it. Women are exempt. They're patur, free from that mitzvah. Eating in the sukkah, which is also at a certain specified time, they're exempt. All those mitzvot that have a time limit for them or a time set for them, women are exempt. Certain cases, though, there are exceptions. Case like eating matzah. That's during the 7 days of Pesach in Eretz Yisrael, or 8 days outside of Israel. This, though it is, there is a set time for it, still this is an exception, or anything in that case, because whenever you have a positive mitzvah, though it's governed by time, but there's also a negative mitzvah against it, then these, in this case, the positive follows the negative. This mitzvah of eating matzah is attached to the mitzvah do not eat chametz, a negative mitzvah. Since she's required to obey the negative mitzvah of not eating chametz, she's also required to obey the positive mitzvah of eating matzah. That's why on Shabbat too, you have the same ruling. She would be exempt because of Shabbat, but still because the negative mitzvot of Shabbat are coincide with the positive ones, therefore she's required to obey Shabbat. This rule, of course, is a rule. The Yemenis says here, there's a general rule about this and all other rules, that every time we have a rule, we cannot be positive about this rule being all-encompassing, because in most cases, all rules have exceptions to the rule. But the rule meaning that just about most or practically all cases, this is the standing rule. If the mitzvah is governed by time, the woman is exempt. If there's no time governing, no time limit, then she is required to fulfill that mitzvah. Mitzvah of tzedakah, for example, there's no set time for it. Mitzvah of respecting parents. So in any mitzvah that doesn't have a time limit to it, she is required to obey. Now the Yemenis says that the mitzvah of teaching a son Torah, there is additional mitzvah of teaching a grandson Torah. This mitzvah is so great that a person who teaches his grandson Torah, he receives the credit as though he was standing at Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, and was learning the Torah then. So great is this mitzvah. So as though he got the Torah from Har Sinai. So precious it is. This of Yeshua Belebi said, the Yemenis says that when the other rabbis heard this, they made sure not to miss out. They had grandchildren, and they struggled very hard, worked hard to be sure to teach their grandchildren Torah. The Yemenis says that one time, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba met Rabbi Shulman Levi, and he had thrown something over his head, not a regular hat, the one he went out in the street with, but something, an ordinary item. He was rushing outside, and he asked him, "What's your hurry?" And he said, "I'm going to bring this child to the yeshiva. This child, my grandson." So he asked the Yeshiva lady, what's the important item here? What's the big deal?" So he said, "You consider that small when the Torah says that it's as though you were standing at Har Sinai receiving the Torah?" That time on, his students were very careful about this. Abba Barhuna would never taste food in the morning, that is the heavy part of the meal, until he would bring a child to the yeshiva. And it's interesting to note that Yemena says that he would not taste food. What kind of food? You know that there's a special law which says every person is required to eat bread in the morning meal. To eat, that means to wash. Breakfast should not be a quickie, not to just take a drink, coffee or something, and then leave. Breakfast is a mitzvah for a person to eat, tafken, especially, specifically, bread to wash for it, because there are certain sicknesses that prevail in this world, especially with the gallbladder, which is a central, integral part of the body. And this, if it's not functioning properly, it injects some of this bitter gall into the other organs. This causes many diseases. The Yemena says there are 83 diseases that come from this gallbladder. The person who washes for bread every morning for breakfast, he will definitely avoid these 83 diseases. So here when the Yemena says that he rushed out without tasting, it means he certainly had bread. He did not eat a regular meal. The Yemena says, what was the regular meal in those days? The regular meal was barbecued meat. They put it over the charcoals, eat barbecued meat in the morning for breakfast. Today is practically unheard of. And yet we see that there is such a thing as eating meat in the morning regularly. But he would forego this part of the meal, so that he could hurry off and take a child to the yeshiva. The Yemena says there is a pasuk in the Kriyat Shema which says Vishinantem Levanecha. Here we have the law, Vishinantem Levanecha, you should teach the Torah to your sons. The Yemena says Vishinantem, there's two nuns, double nun, which means Mishaneh or Mishneh is double. To repeat, Vishinantem. There's an extra no meaning that this means triple. Triple the amount. Triple or divide something into 3/3. The Yemena says, well, here we learn that this is like saying the Shilashtem, Shalosh, three parts. Person should divide his life into three parts. 1/3 of his life, he should learn Chumash, Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim. The 2/3 of his life, he should learn Mishnayot. And the 3rd part of his life, he should learn Gemara. Yemena asks, how can a person ever tell how long he's going to live? How can he foretell the exact number of years he's going to live? He can divide his life that way. Yemena says, we're not speaking about dividing the years of his life. We're speaking about dividing the days of the week. 2 days, first 2 days a week, he should learn Chumash. The second 2 days, learn Mishnah. The 3rd 2 days, to learn Gemara, and Shabbat, review. That's one opinion. A second opinion says that this means every day, not the days of the week, but every single day. Divide the days 1/3 for Chumash, 1/3 for Mishnah, and 1/3 for Gemara. Tosafot says that nowadays it's not necessary because we have what's known today as Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, the Gemara. And the Gemara is a combination of Mishnah, Gemara, and Pesukim. So it's called Bavli because it's Balul, a mixture of these three. So today we are sort of exempt from learning Chumash and Mishnah because we have it right in the Gemara itself. You can go through pages of Gemara, you always find the words V'hatanan, we learned in the Mishnah, and you have Pesukim in the Gemara. So a person learning Bavli, the Gemara, all day will be fulfilling this item of learning Chumash, Mishnah, and Gemara. Secondly, of course, this comes to forewarn another item. The Gemara says that what is the value of the comparative value between the mitzvah learning Chumash, Mishneh, and Gemara? The Gemara tells us that learning Chumash is a very small value. It's a mitzvah, and it's not a mitzvah to learn Chumash, because if you can learn Gemara, the sechah, the reward for learning Gemara is so much greater than learning Chumash that you're losing out on valuable time, valuable credit. The time you're learning Chumash, you can be getting a much greater credit for it. So we see from there that certainly a person should spend more time on on Gemara than on Chumash. Why then do we say here, divide the time completely, equally, the three parts? The answer is that the learning of Chumash, if done properly, is so deep, a person can learn Chumash with such chidushin, deeply as he would learn Gemara. Now, for example, you find that, we mentioned many times, that the Zohar HaKadosh is much harder than Gemara. Now, the Zohar HaKadosh has different parts to it. One is known as the Tikkuni Zohar. The Tikkuni Zohar is so deep, 70 full chapters, that are far deeper and more intricate and more complex than Shas, Gemara. The entire Tikkuni Zohar, the entire 70 chapters, are based only on the one single word Bereshit, explaining that one word Bereshit, so we see the depth of each word in the Chumash. A person could spend a third of the day in Chumash and get the credit of Gemara if he learns Chumash that deeply. Now the Gemara says, let's understand more about Chumash itself. The Gemara says that the first rabbis of the Gemara way back were called Sofrim. Sofrim means scribes, those who write, and Sofrim are what we call the Rabbanan. Now this we find even in the words of Shlomo HaMelech. King Solomon in Kohelet says, V'yoter mehem abeni, izaher midivrei Sofrim. More than you are careful about the laws of Doraita, the actual 630 mitzvot of Doraita, be much more careful with the laws of the Rabbanan. Because the laws of the Doraita of the Torah, the penalty for breaking them, sometimes is Malkut, 39 lashes, sometimes is Karet, sometimes is death. The one who breaks the laws of the Rabbanan, that's much more severe. Breaking any law of the Rabbanan is Chayav Mita, a death penalty for it. Hashem is much more particular about a person's observing strictly the laws of the rabbis, the Rabbanan, than the actual laws in Torah, the Chumash itself, Torah Shebichtav. So we see from that pasuk that Shlomo HaMelech himself called these Rabbanan, Tamidei Chachamim, they called them Sofrim. Even this is these Sofrim, why were they called Sofrim? Where did that word originate from? Because Sofer means to count. They used to count the letters of the Torah, and they designated and showed the importance of each letter. Or, for example, they would show that the counting of the letters is what's known as gimatriaot. The numerical value of each letter designates, signifies, symbolizes something that which we can derive from that word, which amounts to a certain number, we can derive something equivalent to it. For example, the Gemara itself gives us many times. The Gemara says, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu taught us the Torah. That's where the Gemara itself tells us that in this sentence we see what actually transpired at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai, that the Gemara in Shabbat tells us that Hashem spoke to the Jews, and he told them the first two of the Ten Commandments. Anochi Hashem lekecha lo yelecha. At the end of the first two, the power of holiness of Hashem's voice was so great that every one of the Jews died. They couldn't take it. Hashem sent down two angels for each Jew to revive them with the dew of Gan Eden, Chiyat HaMetim, and bringing them back to life. The Jews then begged Moshe Rabbeinu, we cannot take this power of Hashem. Please, you go up to heaven and get the Torah for us. In the Torah, we have 613 mitzvot. So this pasuk says, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. The word Torah is begimetri, a numerical value of 611. Moshe Rabbeinu taught us Torah 611, because two of them we got directly from Hashem. This and many other cases, or Moshe Rabbeinu himself, those two words, Moshe Rabbeinu is begimetri, 613, because he taught us the basic mitzvot. So the word sofrim implies that these chachamim used to count carefully the letters of the Torah. The Gemara says, now that, for one thing, what did these Sofrim find in counting? They counted the letters of the Torah. We're speaking now about the five Chumashim. And in counting the letters, they found that the Pasuk in Parashat Shemini, which says, Kol Holech Al Gachun, speaking about the unkosher animals not fit to eat, or rodents. It says, kol holech al gachon, anyone that crawls on its stomach, referring to the snake, or any other rodent, is unkosher, unfit to eat. So they count on the found that the word gachon, crawling, which is spelled gimel chet vav nun, the vav, and that word is large. It's written large in the Torah. So tell us, it notifies that this vav is the exact middle letter of all the letters of the Torah. They counted the many letters in the Torah, and they found the vav to be the exact middle letter. They also counted the words of the Torah, and they find in the same Parashat Shmini, it says that Ve'et Se'ira Chatat, the time when the two sons of Aharon HaKohen passed away because they brought the strange fire into the Holy of Holies. So, Moshe Rabbeinu searched for the goat that was supposed to be sacrificed for a Korban Chatat, and they had burnt it. So the Pasuk says, Ve'et Se'ira Chatat, Darosh Darash Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu searched for this double word, darosh darash. So they counted and found that, counting the words in the Torah, the in-between is exactly the middle, the number of words in the Torah. Darosh on one side, darash on the other side. That's the exact center of Torah in words. Now, this is a statement which is mentioned in the Gemara here. And the Gemara says to follow this up slightly before we go into it a little more deeply. Yunus says that Rav Yosef asked a question. Interestingly, he asked, when you say that the Vav Av Gachon is the exact middle of the Torah, what do you mean by the middle of the Torah? The Vav belongs to the first half of the Torah? Is this the middle and the Vav belongs to the first half of the letters? Or is this the middle and the Vav belongs to the beginning of the second half? On which side does the Vav belong? So the Yemeni says they answered, well, very simple. Let's take out a Torah and let's count the letters. We'll see. It won't take too long, or no matter how long it takes, it pays to get the answer to this question. So the answer was, we cannot do it. Well, they said, because there was once a question that arose about a certain item in the Torah, and the rabbis, that is the first rabbis, the Chachamim, the Tanaim took out a Sefer Torah, they counted the letters of the Torah, and they solved their problem. So they asked Rav Yosef, why cannot we do it now? The answer was, because, Rav Yosef said, because it would do us no good to count the letters of the Torah. There are certain words where we are not sure today whether there's a letter to be added or not. For instance, certain cases where you have rules. The word Yaakov could be spelled Yud Ay Kuf Vav Bet. The vowel O could be with a Vav, with a dot on it, or without the Vav. So we don't know exactly which places you use for the vowel O with a Vav or without. Now, in other words, we're not sure in many cases, so we might be off a number of letters in the Torah. So what's the use of our counting? We might get the wrong count. Therefore, he said, those rabbis in the past knew exactly each letter of the Torah as far as this chaseh v'yatir, which means where these additional letters of vowels belong, and where they don't, they could count properly, correctly, accurately. We don't know. We're not baki. We don't have a clear knowledge of this, so we cannot answer this question. Therefore, he said, we do not know now exactly what the first Sofrim, the first Chachamim, meant when they said the Vav is the exact half of Torah. On which side does that Vav belong? However, the Gemara accepts clearly the first Chachamim that the Vav is the center of Torah. Now, this point is brought up by the later Acharonim. Later rabbis, later Mefarashim, discuss this point in conjunction with another point. Throughout many Sifrei Kedusha, we find, we once discussed this lightly, we're taking it now a little more deeply, especially in the Zohar Kadosh, other Sifrei, we find the word Yisrael telling us, notifying us that Hashem, the Jews, and the Torah are one. The word Yisrael, Rashi Tevot, the letters stand for Yesh, the Yud is Yesh, the Shin is Shishim, the Resh is Ribu, the Aleph is Otiyot, Lamed is La Torah. Yesh Shishim Ribu Otiyot LaTorah, which means there are exactly 600,000 letters in the Torah. 600,000 letters, that's the Torah, corresponding to the basic 600,000 Nishamot, souls of the Jews. The exact number of letters, the Torah, as there are souls. Which means, just the Mefarish should explain what's so important about that, that anybody who speaks Lashon Hara, who wants to show that, who slanders a Jew, to show that he is pasu, he is not good, it is as though he slandered and spoke against the entire Jewish nation. Proof is that speaking, that finding one letter of the Torah, not all 600,000, but showing that one letter of the Torah is pasu, is not fit, the entire Torah cannot be used anymore. You've got to remove that and change, take a kosher, say for Torah. This is not kosher anymore. So by saying that one Jew is pasul, he makes pasul, he claims pasul the entire Jewish people. That's how important it is to be careful about not speaking against a Jew and thereby keeping the Kedusha of the Sefer Torah. Rabbein Azal says, brings that if a person wants to be zocher, to have a good memory, to learn Torah, remember what he learned, the key, segula, key to that is by never speaking against the Jew. He'll never speak Lashon Hara against any Jew, but he blessed with a tremendous, perfect memory and remembering everything that he photographed, everything he learned. Not to forget any word of Kiddusha of Torah. So, idiot, we have this statement in the Zohar Kadosh to other Sfarim that there are 600,000 letters in the Torah, and this is repeated many, many times throughout. The question is that we did have, Achron did count the letters of the Torah. They found that the number of letters in the Torah are exactly 304,805. That's practically half. It's not that there are just a few letters missing. It's practically half of what the Sifarim claim there are. In other words, we're missing about the exact 295,195 letters from what the Zohar Kadosh and other Sefarim claim. How come there be so large a discrepancy? If there was 1% or 2%, we might say there's some kind of an error that it's on our part, but where it's practically double than what we find in our Chumash, and this Chumash is 100% the Torah we received, how come that these Sefarim claim so large a number, so vast a difference, and they claim it with strength because they base on this claim the entire Chidush of Yisrael, Rashi Tevot, the letters referring to the word Yisrael, all the items we learn from there, we derive from there, how come this tremendous discrepancy? This question is brought up among the great Acharonim, and especially the Chesed Abraham, who was the grandfather of the great Sephardic Posek, the Chida Zal, Rabbi Yosef Chaim David Azulai Zal, the Chida Zal's grandfather, goes into this depth. He discusses this point, and of course, it's something that's mitzvah to attempt to answer, to clarify, not to leave this question in the dark because it's so vast a problem. But he arrives at a conclusion saying that his suggested answer is that when the Sefarim say that there are 600,000 letters in the Torah, they refer to the Miluim. Miluim means that when we take a letter like Aleph, we don't count it just for Aleph alone. We count it for the filling of the letter, the way the letter itself is written up. You want to say the word Aleph, you write Aleph, Lamed, Pei. You want to say the word Yud, you write Yud, Vav, Dalet. So 600,000 letters means that the milui of the letters of the Torah. Each letter, not just as it is in the Torah, but the entire letter as it sounded. Bet is bet yutaf, and so on. So with this, he says, then we can have the total of probably 600,000. This is his attempted answer. The Mishnet Chachamim, which is a later tzaddik, wrote a sefer, and said that he writes in amazement about this point, says he cannot understand, he cannot fathom how the Chesed of Abraham, he has the Israelites, grandfather could make a statement like this, because there is a Zohar Kadosh which says, speaking about the 22, there are 22 letters of the alphabet. If we take those 22 letters of the alphabet, we, for each one, we give the milui, aleph is aleph lamed pei, bet bet yutaf, and so on. And then look at these 22 letters. What happens to the 22? They become exactly 60, which means that it's about the milui. Take the milui instead of the letter itself. So you have a total of 60 instead of 22, which is about 2¾ times as much as the letter themselves. According to this, instead of 304,805, you should now have about, or should have, 838,313 if you take the milui. And that's still 238,000 more than the 600,000 which the Chesed Avraham was trying to reconcile. So, in other words, this would refute the Chesed Avraham's attempted answer by stating that the letters of the Torah means the miluim, the full letters. I hope you're following. So therefore, he rejects this answer, and we are left with this question again. Now, at the same time, another question is brought up, a question that's just as strong. By the way, this question is for those Sfarim that say there are 600,000 letters in the Torah. How about the Gemara itself here, which states that the Vav of Gachur is the exact middle letter of the Torah? Now, if it's the middle letter of the Torah, we know the number of letters in the Torah today are 304,805. If that is so, then exactly half should be 152,403. And yet, if you count off to the Vav of Gachon, you'll find the Vav of Gachon is the 157,236, approximately 5,000 letters off. And this is a clear statement in the Gemara, clear, stated by that the Sofrim themselves, the Chachamim, counted and they found this to be the middle letter, which of course, again, presents us with a very big dilemma, a problem that's amazing in size. Now, there are other suggested answers. One of the later rabbis says that, note, let's just note this for a moment. Remember that Yosef asked the question. He asked, is the Vav of Gachon, this middle letter, is it on the last letter of the first half of the Torah, or is it the first letter of the second half of the Torah? How come he did not ask, is it the exact middle letter, meaning an equal number on both sides, which is the actual truth? Because in truth, there are 152,402 letters on each side, which would total 304,804, middle letter being the Vav Gachon. Why didn't he ask that question, which is actually the truthful question, true case? Therefore, we must say, or we could say, these are all suggested answers. Each one attempts to answer this. Two possible answers. One is that Ignaz says clearly that at Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, the Torah was given, and it says, Beferush clearly, the Torah was given, united, together came the Chumash and the Targum. Both came simultaneously. One without the other is impossible. Targum Refodash, we find that a Pasuk in the Navi too. The Menadim says that both came together at Har Sinai, Chumash and Targum, and therefore, Mikra and Targum, and therefore, we have to say Mikra and Targum, but we are Ma'avir Sedret. Shnei Mikra V'yachad Targum, every Shabbat, cover the parasha. Now, if we take the Mikra and Targum together, the Targum is not exactly the same number of letters as the Mikra, but very, very close to it. So it could be that the 304,000 letters plus of the Chumash, 295,000 plus of the Targum, this could make up the exact number of 600,000. Except if it's a few letters off, then of course, as the Rebbe says here, we're not sure about certain letters, the vowels, whether they are counted or not. We might get very close to it. That's one answer. Second answer, which is deep and very obvious, or very possibly they could answer this question completely, is the fact that throughout the Torah we find always, throughout the Gemara, referring to the Chumash, it says, Yesh Em Lamikra, Yesh Em Lamisora, which means that if you note many times in the Chumash, there is a Kiri and a Ketiv. In today's parasha, we have also Shnei Goyim Bevetnech. It's spelled, Hashem said that you have two Goyim Bevetnech. It's spelled Gimel Yud Yud Mem, pronounced Geyim. The Kri is Goyim. It's written like Geyim. The Kri is Goyim, or Tomim, where you have certain letters missing, or according to the Ketiv, or added. This is the way it must be written in the Torah, though we read orally, the reading is different. So, naturally, the Kri would be less than the Ketiv. Now, here we have a total of 304,805 letters written in the Torah. That means we're missing 295,000. 195. We're missing about 8,000 more, a difference of 8,000, equal amount to total 600,000. Of course, the Ketiv would be more, because the Ketiv, you have letters where you have to write them in, a silent Aleph, silent Hey. When you read it, those letters are silent. So you have less letters in the Kri, in the reading. Enough letters to make up this difference of 8,000 difference, so that then you could really have a total of 600,000. If somebody wants to try counting it, comparing it, then we can really prove how exact this is. But the logic here is 100% clear logic, that this is what is meant by the Sifrei Kodesh, who say 600,000 letters to the Torah, because the letter says Yesh Im and Yesh Im. Both the Torah is like a mother to the Jews, nourishes the Jews, and both the Kri, the way it's read, and the Ketiv, the way it's written, are both called a mother, which means that both are fully the Torah. Both are different, and therefore both together comprise the Torah of 600,000 letters. And the Gemara continues and says, again, we find another slight problem, comparatively very small. The Gemara says that in counting the Pesukim, the sentences of the Chumash, the five Chumashim, there are 5,888 Pesukim in the Torah. And actually, you have it written down at the end of every Chumash. It says there are 5,845 Pesukim. At the end of the Vedim, you have written there each Chumash, which means there's 43 Pesukim in our Chumash less than what the Gemara says. So that's not too much of a question, because probably the Gemara itself says many cases where we do not know where to put a period. It might be a pasuk that's divided into two or three parts, and we don't have the period in the right place. We have etnachta, so that we could make a mistake with 43 sentences, 43 periods, out of 5,888, make 43 less. Why don't we correct it? Because we are not baki. We don't have the clear knowledge of where these periods belong. So that's why this point, we do have a discrepancy where the explanation is a very simple one, a clear one. The Gemara says, now we're speaking about the word Vishinantem. This point is vital. Vishinantem levanecha, teach to your children. Teach. It comes to the word learn. Learn and teach. The Gemara says, when you learn Torah, you want to teach, make sure that the Torah, the word shinatem, shinina means sharp, very sharp as a sword. Make sure that the words of Torah are very, very sharp, clear in your mind, and then first speak them out. They should be so clear that if a person asks you a question in Torah law or a question explaining a part of the Torah, whether it's Chumash, Gemarat, make sure that you know the answer very clearly and sharply before you answer it. Because the Torah says, Emor l'chachma achlati at. Tell the Chachma, the wisdom of Torah, you're my sister. It's the clearest knowledge possible. Each person knows that the sister is forbidden for a brother. As clear as that simple law is, that's how clear every single word of Torah should be to you. The wisdom of Torah. So that person should see to it when he studies Torah to learn it very clearly and sharply, understand it in depth, and then to go about teaching this. And of course, the word Vashinantem, Levanecha, to your sons, this means also to your students. How do you become sharp? When you teach students, you become sharper than when you learn from a rabbi, because students make you sharp. So the combination of rabbi and students learning Torah together is the greatest combination.